I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk.
When, after a detailed review of Nazi achievements, Hitler cries, "My life's fight has not been in vain."
Indem ich euch hier blicke, weiß ich, mein Lebenskampf ist nicht umsonst gekämpft.
Really? Hitler? Is that where we're heading? Nuremberg on the National Mall come January? Minus the German, if Donald Trump is elected. Talk of Trump as Hitler, once just the cry of a few alarmed historians and left-wing Democrats, was all the rage in the mainstream media this week after former Trump chief of staff, retired Marine Corps General John Kelly, went on the record calling the once and possibly future president of the United States a fascist. Kelly also said Trump wished he had generals like Hitler's. But a would-be dictator first needs an army of diehard devotees, right? And right now, Trump is drawing his, as did Hitler, it must be said, largely from discontented, alienated, youngish white men. And it's from these pools of men that threats and actual acts of violence have sprung. Sometimes, of course, it has nothing to do with ideology. Witness the two assassination attempts on Trump by deeply disturbed malcontents. But largely, it's militant groups on the far right, like the Proud Boys, the American Patriots 3% Militia, the Oath Keepers, the Boogaloo Boys, and so forth, that have engaged in intimidation and actual violence. More is widely expected on Election Day, November 5th. And if Trump doesn't win next January, not just in Washington, D.C., but around the country. There's been no shortage of alarms about that, but what about efforts to deter or mitigate the migration of young white males from their lonely, simmering discontent to violence-prone groups? What's been done? What's being done? And has any of it been successful? That's my subject today with Clara Burkhart, an intelligence analyst with the Soufan Group, a leading New York-based organization specializing in terrorist threats of all kinds. The Belgian-born Burkhart conducts open-source investigations aimed at providing actionable intelligence to enhance security for the company's clients. Before joining the Soufan Group, she specialized as an intelligence analyst in foreign information manipulation and interference, with a focus on critical infrastructure, elections, and public health. She also worked as a research fellow at Diverting Hate, where she identified and tracked online threats of violent attacks. Clara Burkhart, welcome to Spy Talk. Now, we are barreling toward an election under darkening clouds of intimidation and violence from the most militant corners of Trump's MAGA world, stoked covertly in social media by malignant foreign actors like Russia and Iran. First, is the threat overblown? How much of it is real? I'm reminded of the folk tale of Chicken Little, who thinks an acorn falling on his head means that the sky is falling. Is this being pumped up by interested parties? I mean, parties who have an interest in blowing up this threat and nailing it to Trump. What do you think?
Well, I first of all think that, you know, the political violence that we're currently talking about, obviously there is a real threat coming from the far right, but it's definitely not just the far right. And I also think when you talk about, is the threat being overblown, I think we should talk about what we're seeing online versus what we're seeing in the physical world. Online, what we're seeing, and there are some great reports out there at the Sufan Center. We're doing some data collection ourselves, but the Institute for Strategic Dialogue has also put out some really interesting reports recently. And it shows that, you know, in August and September, violent extremist accounts really were primarily posting on Telegram, and that much of it was actually racially and ethnically motivated. And only the second most content was about, you know, anti-government conspiracies and anti-authority violent extremist content. So that's what we're seeing online.
Right. So the question is this palpable in, you know, a farming community in Iowa or Nebraska or South Dorchester, Massachusetts? I mean, is this something on people's minds? And are people riled up in real life? I mean, we know we've seen some attacks. I'm not minimizing that. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me you've brought up a very good point that there's a difference between living online and living in real life.
Absolutely. And this is, I think, again, the distinction that needs to be made offline. What we've seen over the past years since 2020 is that these organized groups and militias, such as, you know, the Proud Boys and other, you know, neo-Nazi groupings, their activity and their incidents have actually plummeted since 2020.
They have plummeted.
Yes. There is a, you know, a great nonprofit I'm sure you're familiar with, ACLED, who has a fantastic product called the U.S. Crisis Monitor. And you look at kind of incidents of political violence and mobilization by different actors. And if you look at their data set, which I was really impressed by, it's actually going down since 2020. But that's just not organized groups, right? Jeff, that's not just an individual like, you know, our Thomas Crooks, who's shot at the former president, was not, you know, an organized individual.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So the organized groups that we've linked to violence, Proud Boys, etc. Just to recap, you're saying that violent incidents by them have plummeted, but then you have, let's call them self-starters, deranged, for lack of a better term, deranged individuals who've taken upon themselves to commit violence, like the attacks on Trump. That's really interesting. So does that mean that perhaps some of these organized groups are lying in wait quietly? I've seen some reporting about leadership of these groups telling their members, stay quiet, stay low, wait till you get the signal, so to speak.
There is definitely that fear. I also think that these groups are far better organized than other individuals, right? So their operational security online is considerably better than other non-organized groups. So it's harder to infiltrate their communities and understand what they're actually saying, whether they're plotting, planning anything. So that's another issue.
Excuse me, I have to interrupt here. We know the FBI had the leader of Proud Boys and others as informants.
Yes.
Now, of course, they weren't informing on what the Proud Boys themselves were doing. The FBI was using them to try to find out what Antifa was doing and so on. Right?
Exactly.
So are you saying that as far as you know, and it's hard to know definitively as an outsider, but you're an expert. So is your feeling and your conversations with officials, does that lead you to believe that the feds or state and local intelligence units have no grip on what these groups are doing, or they have some grip, or what? What's your estimate?
I do think they have some grip, but I do think there is also more focus right now on, you know, what we've seen in Pennsylvania and Michigan of just people all of a sudden going, you know, harassing people that show their political preference. You had, I want to say, in Pennsylvania, people rallying for Harris. That were kind of attacked and harassed by a man who was clearly not a Harris supporter. But at the same time, in Michigan, you saw someone who drove over a person that was putting up a Trump sign. So I think those kind of attacks, those harassments, those threats are way harder to counter because they seem to arise so spontaneously.
And then there are death threats. I mean, one of the most high-profile cases is the Maricopa County voting registrar. I'm not sure that's the exact title, but and he, who is a Republican. He was just defeated by a Trump partisan in the elections, and I dare say he's glad that he's not going to be in office anymore because he and his family have been subjected to all sorts of violent threats. So do you count that in your calculus of the level of real violence we're facing right now?
Absolutely. And I think that's probably of all components of this. This is my main concern of violence, that is, of violence against officials that are involved in the election administration, but also election infrastructure. And I don't mean to make this, you know, a horror show podcast, but if you look at a poll from the Brennan Center back from May 2024, you find that about 38% of local elections officials have experienced threats and harassment and abuse, and that about one-third of local election officials know at least one person who resigned, at least partly, due to safety concerns. And to add to this kind of threat assessment I'm making, recently ProPublica had a really interesting investigation that it did. And it was the fact that activists that deny the outcomes of the 2020 election are not just trying to recruit poll observers to make sure everything's, you know, going according to plan, no voter fraud takes place. They're now actually also trying to recruit, you know, poll workers who help administer elections in the swing states. And then from where I'm sitting, I'm thinking what that interaction looks like between this clearly very ideologically driven person who's recruited by an activist versus the average poll worker who sits there and who just wants to, you know, do their work and administer the election.
Wow. I hadn't heard that part about recruiting poll workers, but we've seen some reporting lately on, you know, recruiting groups to monitor the voting sites, which can be very intimidating in particular contexts if they're like militant, violent white guys in a black-dominated area where there's been a history of violence against black people. This could be very threatening and dampen the vote. Again, what are local officials doing, or the feds doing, if anything, to thwart this kind of violence or this threat?
So what's being done versus what needs to be done is, of course, also an interesting conversation to have.
Sure.
But let's give credit where credit is due. Since June 2021, the U.S. Department of Justice's Election Threat Task Force has received, you know, over 2,000 reports of, you know, threats and harassment from election workers. And there have been a number of legal persecutions that have come out of that. We have also seen, you know, enhanced physical security at polling locations that authorities are implementing, bolstering the capabilities and the security of the Capitol Police.
Does that mean that local officials or the feds or whoever are going to show up at these polling sites to protect the polls, protect voters and poll workers?
I think there will be more law enforcement presence. My concern as a researcher looking at this, who's also previously worked on things such as disinformation and foreign interference, is that we need to avoid at all costs that we see the politicization or the perception of the politicization of domestic counterterrorism work or any initiatives to counter political violence.
Let's define it. What do you mean by that, to avoid the politicization of counter violence, counterterrorism work?
Well, I think this to some extent, unfortunately, happened to the prevention and mitigation of the spread of disinformation, where to some extent it became politicized and then harmed the overall noble endeavor of ensuring content that may lead to offline violence gets removed and gets squared away. I want to avoid that the word political violence gets that same radiance of toxic radiance of like, oh, it's just a leftist concept rather than an objective threat assessment and an objective and noble pursuit of protecting the American public. And that's hard. That's a hard thing to do.
It sure is. I remember that conservative, quote unquote, forces demanded that DHS scrap its program to monitor domestic violence, saying it was a Democratic idea to suppress conservative political activity. And that was a few years ago. And I take it that DHS has not remounted any organized campaign to do this, right?
Well, yeah, that the I think it was called the Disinformation Governance Board, right? It was so criticized that it had to kind of wind down operations and never really saw light of day. I do think authorities are taking this seriously. And I think we have seen also some, you know, conservative voices raising alarm of this threat. My opinion is, you know, political violence is not just a far right MAGA problem. So it should be, a bipartisan or rather nonpartisan pursuit, because we're helping just to prevent violence rather than, you know, any political motive. It's not an ideologically tainted concept.
Right. Do you sense that foreign malign actors like Russia and China, their activities on social media are having much of an effect, or is far right violence or expressions of violence, is that a self-licking ice cream cone, or do the Russians and other malign actors, are they making a difference?
Well, whether they're present and amplifying divisive narratives, yes, 100%. Put my hand in the fire, yes. But whether it's making a difference and how to measure that is really difficult. With previous issues, we've seen this as well, with such things such as QAnon and everything. Like, we know there is foreign interference there. Does it do anything? And by talking too much about foreign interference, do we risk, not actually talking about the cause, which is distinctly domestic? And I think in the QAnon case, that was the case. It was a domestic issue, and there was foreign interference, but it should not take space over what was happening.
Unwind that a little bit. QAnon, which is this bizarre conspiracy cult. Could you restate that and drill down on what you meant about foreign interference and QAnon?
Yeah, absolutely. So QAnon was this, obviously, conspiracy theory that, by the way, still in, you know, the depths of the internet, has quite some following, which is this idea that there's a global cabal, a global conspiracy of people trafficking children.
Democrats are trafficking in children and Jews. Yeah. Anyway, this is being financed by Jews. It's strong anti-Semitic content.
100% anti-Semitic, very conspiratorial, includes the Pope as well for some reason. So, what has been called like salad bar ideology, mix and match, and patch together an ideology that works for your worldview. But what was interesting about QAnon is that, like, while it was such a enticing narrative to amplify by foreign actors, which is just, by the way, the case with any divisive narrative, it was a domestic issue. It was domestically spread. It was domestic rallies that were being held around that pizza joint in Washington, D.C., where supposedly children were being held by Democrats, you know. All of these things were domestic issues.
Yeah, just to remind people, and that took place only about three blocks from my house, by the way.
Really? Really?
Yeah, and I went over that night when I heard the police reports. It was a guy who drove up from North Carolina. He was totally soaked. He was drunk with conspiracy theories. He drove all the way up from North Carolina in the belief that children were being held in the basement of a pizza joint that was owned by a prominent local Democrat and friend of the Clinton administration. So he went in there with an AR-15 type rifle, and I think he even fired it. He even blew the lock off or something. Of course, there was no basement, not to mention children being held. He seems to be a prototype of the kind of person that that you have worried about, was young, white, angry males. You have done work with diverting hate. which was a very interesting group to me, which it tries to target these young white males and target them with positive messages, right? Yes. And divert them, try to wean them off or wean them away from their conspiracy worlds. Tell us a little bit about that work.
Absolutely. So Diverting Hate is a program that received a grant through the Department of Homeland Security to do exactly that, to use basically ad technology to divert people that are entering the kind of oftentimes algorithmically amplified echo chambers of, you know, hateful ideologies. In this particular case, we were looking at people who were looking to commit violence against women, gender-based motives, what we also call the incel movements, people who do not find relationships with women.
And you say you were looking for them. How were you looking for them?
Well, we know what sites they frequent and where their radicalization tends to take place. It tends to start quite, innocently, videos that discuss what I think are very noble and normal issues to discuss, the gender inequality and the specific issues men may face in society, in modern society, all of these things which I think are healthy and in a democracy need to be discussed and addressed. But then from there, what sometimes happens is through algorithms, but also just through, you know, comment sections, people get diverted away from that initial piece of content to really dark places where people are basically espousing hatred for women, wanting to kill them, but also, which I need to note, in the case of incels, kind of promote almost suicide, you know, what they call black pilling.
You would find these groups, just to recap, you find these groups online. Again, this is happening online, very much like how ISIS operates, I might say, and other, you know, foreign terrorist groups. So there are these men's groups online to discuss, you know, legitimate issues of gender disparity, or there are groups where they could voice their discomfort with the advancement of women, let's say, in society, and how young men are falling behind in American society in terms of education and so on. And so it starts out there, and then the group is manipulated, or someone on their own gets fired up and is sort of picked off by a violent group.
Well, I think there's what I think it's not a, you know, central by any means centralized. It's more so that once you have seen like a piece of content that discusses, for example, the high suicide rates among men in the West, or you know, struggles of men in the West, you may then be diverted to a video that's even more dark and blames that on women rather than on maybe economic circumstances or anything else. And from there are specific forums they can be directed to, which are what we call incel forums, where people clearly are not just very depressed, but some of them are actually interested in committing violent acts.
Incels, this is shorthand for people who are upset that they're not having sex.
Yes, that they don't have romantic relationships, and that they feel basically that the fact that they don't have sex, that they don't have romantic relationships, leaves them out of society.
And they blame that on what? The government? The Democrats?
Well, this is
women?
Interesting, right? Yeah, this is interesting. There are different, they blame it on a host of different people. But I want to make sure that this comes across. Many of these people are by no means violent. They're actually just very depressed, right? But in that community, you find people that radicalize into, you know, posting things such as, today I was this close to, you know, stabbing a woman, because here she is, what they call Stacy's very attractive woman.
Say that again. They are what?
They have this specific lingo where they, for example, call attractive women who have supposedly access to all the men that they want, Stacy, the name. And so it's basically what you do is you help people while they're going through this kind of downward spiral through ad technology, try to redirect them towards interesting men groups that are not, you know, promoting violence and that are actually just really nice mental health resources for men that are struggling.
Is it a case of outside violence-prone groups that infiltrate these discussion groups and sort of pick off these people? Or, again, do they just pick up some piece of conspiratorial junk, believe it, embrace it, and self-radicalize?
I think it's self-radicalization. And again, a small percentage of those actually on those forums.
And dealing with them and diverting hate, they try to, the idea was to send them positive messages and that would kind of turn them around. Tell us how that works and how successful, if you've been able to measure any success on that.
Well, from our side, when we work with, you know, advertisement technology, what this means is someone who's watching a video about, for example, that women are to blame on all societies or modern societies' ills, on nuanced videos, they would receive a kind of advertisement on that specific screen targeted towards them that redirects them when they click on it to another men's group that potentially discusses some of these issues, but not from a perspective of, you know, either hatred or violence.
Well, that sounds pretty dull. I mean, it seems to me if some guy is fired up, he's alienated, he's depressed and so on, you know, inviting some men's therapy group is not an exciting alternative. So there are methods, right? I mean, there are some groups who say they've gotten, you know, well-known professional athletes, stars, well-known country and Western musicians and so on to beam this message at these alienated, violent, potentially violent young men and say, this is not the way to go? Is that one of the best techniques?
Well, you should not kind of picture a kumbaya, let's talk about our emotions kind of group that they're redirected to. It's more so really cool. I mean, from my perspective, cool men's groups that are just kind of really still talk about everything masculine, that just do not engage with violent content. They talk about issues, economic issues, about specific, also just activities like going fishing and stuff. It's not softy stuff, but definitely I understand as well the perspective is if someone's fired up, is what they want to do engage with solutions, or do they actually just want to engage with hateful content? And that's an issue that doesn't redress, of course.
Is there a key message that you have discovered works or key messages that seems to get to these young alienated violence, potentially violent men? Have you identified any messages that work better than others?
I think everything that has to do with traditional healthy masculinity, working out, taking care of yourself, making money, you know, those things tend to resonate. It's not, that's what resonates. It's not about, you know, let's sit around and talk about our emotion. That resonates, of course. So traditional healthy masculine messages tend to resonate with them.
And the messenger is really important. So who are the messengers?
Well, I'm no longer with Diverting Hate and I won't disclose it, but these are healthy.
I understand.
Healthy men's, you know, men's groups that work in this space.
But you do work in this space, is the current term, the space of, you know, violent extremism and so on. From all your experience with not just Diverting Hate, but your entire work, your body of work and your experience, what do you think is a message or messages that can reach these alienated, for the most part, young men?
I think if we want to approach this question kind of honestly.
Yeah, that's the idea here.
It is. I think we have in society with, you know, polarization, we have really taken a turn to a lot of identitarian issues, like everything related to identity politics, identity culture, rather than some of the real big issues that I think from left to right, everyone, every gender is struggling with, which is, you know, economic issues, which is also just the enormous impact that globalization of economy has had on just how we live life, how we have become, you know, households with two people working. We have deflected a lot to issues such as gender and, you know, political kind of culture. But what I think that is really important and what can be an important message for people to de-radicalize is talk about the issues we can all agree upon. I know it's not easy in this landscape, but it's definitely something that needs to be done.
Definitely something needs to be done. And that's what here we talk about. I mean, you know, you and your colleague Colin Clark wrote a very important piece on the Lawfare site, delineating all these violent threats. You know, it was a very comprehensive piece. And I must say, we know now, you know, we know of all the violent threats. I think people are crying out for solutions, how to deal with it, what's being done to stop it and to know what and to find out what's effective and what's not. It seems to me, and maybe I've missed it, are there television ads or social media ads featuring, you know, with actors or, you know, important, you know, look, we are the greatest advertising society in the world. I mean, Madison Avenue, my God, we know how to sell soap in this country. We know how to sell pro football. We know how to sell lots of stuff. We're very, very cars, pizza. We're very, very good at it. Where are the ads and the ad campaigns that go right at this issue and say during a commercial break during Sunday football, you know, a really gripping ad that grabs young men and says, hey, violence is not the way to go. Blaming women is not the way to go. Are there any ad campaigns like that?
Well, no, and I think you identified why we don't. And that's, you need a messenger that people all like. And that's not easy in a polarized society.
It is not easy. I didn't say it was easy.
Yeah. But when we talk about political violence specifically, if you want to address it, political violence lays at the kind of intersection between these macro trends, such as, you know, polarization, democratic backsliding, and micro trends. Like, we know there are certain psychological characteristics that make people more likely, or I should say, are correlated with perpetrating political violence. And this includes things such as authoritarian tendencies, victimhood mentality. So what I want to kind of say here is that the solution to addressing political violence is, and this is so cliche,
We're eager to hear the solution to political violence. Believe me, I'm on the edge of my seat.
And I'm going to absolutely disappoint because I'm going to have to bring in a cliche, which is it takes a lot of freaking stakeholders because we don't just need to be addressing, you know, democratic backsliding and have people politicizing the judiciary, clinging on to criticizing the democracy to keep their political status. At the same time, we have to work on the micro, right? Like, how do you stop the conditions that make radicalization possible? These tend to be social in nature, economic in nature. Do you think it's easier to radicalize someone who, you know, feels content with their salary and who knows how to pay their, you know, meat and vegetables? Like, it is interesting that it takes solutions on all levels, from economic to social, to actually redress this issue.
For sure. I think anyone who's paying attention would know that the problem of, you know, women leapfrogging men in the educational sphere, the erosion of industrial jobs that used to be available. Anybody could graduate from high school or not even graduate from high school and go around the corner and work in the same factory that their father or their grandfather or their great-grandfather worked in. That's not so available anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's going to take a long-term change, and we better get at it actually soon. But in the meantime, we have a looming threat right now of violence around the elections, and the one candidate, Trump himself, threatening violence if he doesn't win the election. So, are you saying that, you know, rustling up a bunch of money? Look, the Harris campaign raised $1 billion in the last 2 months. You're saying there's no money available, or it would be a waste of money to do a mass advertising campaign since, you know, the basic lives of these young men is not change. We have to wait for that to change. Are there any techniques that we can use right now to blunt this threat?
I think in terms of obviously bolstering security at key government buildings and making sure poll workers are safe through increased law enforcement presence, all of those things, yes. But when you're telling me about asking me about the prevention, I want to kind of say, like, people have a hard time if their fridge is not full and they're worrying about money to care about an advertisement that calls for unity. You know, that's I know that's not maybe the high note we want to end this on, but that's really what I think.
Yeah, I wanted you to offer a bulletproof solution here. I think boiled down, what you're saying is that no amount of persuasion, slick persuasion during the football game, let's say, that might last for a couple of minutes. Someone might give second thoughts to their violent thoughts, and their anger might calm them down for a while. But when they look at an empty fridge or they don't have a job, that smacks them back to reality. And that fundamental changes have to take place in society before the ocean of sentiment that fuels the violence will dissipate. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. But I do not want to at all give the impression that there is no agency or accountability, because many people with empty fridges and many monetary worries and material concerns do not engage in this. So there are individual factors that we'll also need to be able to drill down on and still detect through, you know, intelligence, through surveillance, to understand who's going to commit an attack.
Right. And that prompts me to ask my final question. It's good to point out that most men are not, you know, signing up, picking up a rifle or whatever, want to burn down the place. So if you look at a big picture, if you had to make a guess, if you had to make a wager, would you bet that an army of malcontents is going to follow Trump over the ledge come next January if he doesn't win? Are we likely to see a repeat? I mean, I know a lot of new security measures have been put in place for the U.S. Capitol, so they're not going to be unprepared this time. But do you suspect that even more thousands of people might show up next January 6th?
I'm not sure if it will be specifically at the Capitol and at the moment that, you know, the vote is being certified. But unfortunately, when I look at where we are right now, with already kind of preemptively certain corners of the right saying there's voter fraud, well, yes, then I do think we're going to see civil unrest, but also potentially violence after the election.
If Trump elsewhere, at state capitals, county capitals, and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, on that happy note, wow, we have to wrap it up. Claire Brokart, thanks so much for spending your time with us, even if it's kind of depressing for both of us, for all of us. But it's not going away. We'll be addressing this for a long time to come, unfortunately. But let's hope for better days, right?
Absolutely.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks much for listening. I hope you found it interesting. You can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available at our home at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly edited and produced by Kanai at MSW Media. Love you, man. Love all you listeners, too. That's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
M-S-W.
KSW Media.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.